A good Thursday evening to everyone. This is Blue Hen Sports Cage on 91.3 WVUD. Our big stories. The Cleveland Indians making a move last night as they continue their hunt back towards the World Series. Jay Bruce, three-time All-Star, going from New York to Cleveland. Mets get rid of him and continue to look at a possible rebuild.
About an hour ago across the pond, Matthew Senchwich Jr. was upset in the 1,500-meter preliminary rounds, two rounds away from the final, and Senchwich was dead last in his heat and will not advance to the final. Just a year ago in Rio, Senchwich was the first male to win gold in the 1,500 meters since 1908, but he will not advance this year in London at the World Championships.
Sticking with track and field, Usain Bolt loses his final 100-meter race at the World Championships. Justin Gatlin wins gold.
We're very excited right now to welcome in Delaware volleyball head coach Sarah Matthews, coming over from TCU, getting started only a little while until the season gets going. Great to have you, coach.
Thanks for having me.
So far, you've been here for a little while. You got hired in January. You've had some time to acclimate yourself. Overall impression so far, what's it been like to get started here in Newark?
It's been awesome. The energy level that Chrissy, our athletic director, has brought to the entire athletic department has been really neat to be a part of, and I think it's filtering down all the way to the athletes, and they're just getting this new sense of support from administration, and that everyone's on board and wants to see Delaware do great things nationally.
So going off of that, you talk about Chrissy, I'm sure, in your conversations with her, as you talked about that possible move here. What made this job attractive to you?
There was a lot of things that made it attractive. You know, it was an interesting situation when they contacted me about interviewing. I wasn't really at a place where I was looking to move on. I was in a great situation where I was at. And I really said that everything had to be perfect for that situation to happen. And when I met Jen Judy, who's our SWA, the very first time, there was just something about Delaware and it kind of being this hidden gem, I guess, and we're hoping to get to the point where it's not a hidden gem and everyone knows about us. But when I stepped on campus with my husband, a couple of things really stood out. So obviously the athletic department is really supporting our program, which is huge, and the campus is beautiful, the academics are great, and it's a place where I feel like we can win. So that was really, really important.
Before you came to Delaware, just as a whole, what did you know about the state? What was your experience with Delaware? Because not a lot of people are necessarily from here. It's one of the smaller states on the East Coast, and you called it a hidden gem. What did you know about Delaware before you came?
I knew nothing about Delaware before I came. I knew nothing about it, and I didn't really know even how close proximity it is to so many major cities and how many attractions are so close to here. And that was another big draw for my family is
right.
There's a lot to do around here in the state, and we love the beach, and so that's so close. And it's great weather in the summer, and winters are a little different, but it's not quite as cold as I thought it was going to be. So
quite the change coming from Texas.
Yes, for sure. But summers have been drastically better. It's not over 100 degrees for the entire month of July.
And it cools down pretty quickly here. So when you were talking to Chrissy and talking about what she envisions for the Delaware volleyball program, what were some of the things she communicated and maybe how she sees, because this is only her second full year now starting, how she sees that program and maybe what you're going to do with it fitting in with the overall theme of the athletic department?
I think it's a program that they really feel like can be successful for UD Athletics. And you know, there's been success in the past with the volleyball program, and I think that we can get back to the point where we're there again. Like I said, with the resources that they're giving us and the talent that we have and the kids that we're bringing in, we really feel like we can be contending for a conference championship every year.
So just getting to know you a little bit, coming in from TCU and your experiences in the past, what do you consider some of your skills, some of your strengths that you think that not just any volleyball team, something that may fit with this volleyball team and some of the things that you try to pride yourself on as a coach?
I think one of the biggest things is creating an environment that is really positive for our players and creating that team culture where they feel like they want to be a part of it. So, some people might say it's a player's coach, but I like to have that relationship with my players where we have high expectations and we push them, but at the end of the day, they know that we care about them and that it's all about making our program better as a whole.
So you come in here after a little bit of controversy. We'll keep it on the DL here with the wordage that we use. But surely you're aware of what went on over a little while, and we're not going to beat the horse to dead here. But how do you establish, as a new coach coming in, and a mix of new players and players who have been here, how do you establish a new regime, and how do you create a, you know, this is Sarah Matthews' program. This is a Delaware volleyball program. We are moving on to, you know, a new light and a whole bunch of things that I am excited to bring. How do you establish that? What are some of the things you do to your team? What are some of the things you say and some of the steps that you take?
Well, I think the biggest thing is it's not a Sarah Matthews volleyball program. It's UD volleyball program. And that's one of the biggest things that we've been trying to push with our players is we want them leading this front. It can't come from the coaching staff. At the end of the day, they're the ones on the court. They're the ones that are going to win, and we're going to provide them as many tools as we can. But we really pushed them in the spring when we were working through team culture that they have to start taking that lead, and it can't come from us. And so I think that I was really excited when our staff got here that the players bought in from day one and wanted to do great things with this program. And they were on board for everything that we've tried. Even if it was maybe out of their comfort zone a little bit or different than what they've experienced, they've 100% bought into what we're doing, and they're all about making the program better.
Last fall, we had Martin Inglesby on the show before he started as a men's basketball coach. And we asked him, you know, what have you seen from your players? And he said, I didn't watch any Delaware basketball because I didn't want any preconceived notions of what my players could or couldn't do.
Mm-hmm.
What was your approach to that sort of thing, to get to know your players? Did you watch any Delaware volleyball from last year, or did you kind of come in with that open mind, clean slate?
I came in with same as Martin, with a clean slate, and didn't watch film intentionally, so we could come in and people could kind of start fresh. And that was interesting dynamics working through with some of the players, of getting them to the point where they looked at things differently, and maybe they were in a different role previously with the old coaching staff, and they needed to learn how to move on from that and maybe take a different role, a bigger role, or a different role and positionally of what they were doing. So, yeah, same approach that we came in with, just wanting to get to know them as much as we could as people and seeing what they could do on the court once we got here.
I'll ask you very simply, do you feel like there's the pressure's on for your first year, or do you feel like you just want to go out and get the work in, or are you just looking to go all in and get those conference wins and championships and all that?
Well, everyone wants to win conference, right? I hope so. I mean, we're that's why we were hired to win. So at the end of the day, college athletics is about winning, but for us, that we stress for our girls is it's about the process of getting there, and it's not going to happen overnight, and we have to be patient and stick with our system and what we're doing, and stick with continuing to buy in when things seem a little rough. And who knows, we might have some rough patches going into this first year of things still being new. We had a good core group of returners in the spring and a pretty large amount. So they were really well established coming into the summer, and we have some great leaders. Daria, who's our only senior, has been awesome over the summer and working the new freshmen into open gym. So they were at a really good place when we got here for preseason. And so we're pretty excited about what we think we can do this year.
You mentioned the seniors and that she is the only one. The team lost 6 seniors from last year to this year.
Mm-hmm.
And considerably speaking, this is a younger squad.
Mm-hmm.
How do you find that veteran leadership with such a young squad?
I think that Daria has been the key, because she's helping. I mean, obviously she plays a big role being that senior, but she's really done a great job of helping incorporate the younger players into leadership roles. And we're working with, we don't really have, I guess, a true captain. So we more have a rule by committee, I guess, where we have representatives from each class that are on a leadership committee, and they can work together to, so everyone has a voice, everyone feels like they have a part in the team, and you don't want to get to the point where you lose a senior and then have to start over. So hopefully that will continue as we're going, where we have leaders in each class that can kind of move things along.
So far through out-of-season practices and into the preseason, what have you seen from the freshmen that you're bringing into the team?
Well, so we can't work with them in the summer like basketball can. So our girls were here doing summer school and open gym, but we're not allowed to be in there watching. So okay. We've only seen the freshmen for 2-3 days of practice. So we're just getting to know them and they're just getting acquainted. I think it's always a large change for freshmen coming in because the speed of the college game is so much faster than club and high school. One of our freshmen, Courtney Roberts, who's a setter, was here in the spring, so she graduated early and came in February with the rest of the group. So she was here for a whole semester to help get acquainted, which helped tremendously, and she's been a really good leader with that freshman class of helping them kind of move along a little bit faster. But we haven't really gotten enough in those couple days to really see what our freshmen can do, but we're looking forward to some big things out of them.
We're talking to Delaware Volleyball Head Coach Sarah Matthews here on Blue Hen Sports Cage. Sarah, you've had experience with volleyball for some time now. In your mind, what are the top qualities that you look for in a player? What are those traits, both on and off the court?
So I think you need a mix of different types of players on your team. You obviously need some great athletes where you have those kids that can jump and have a great arm, but you also need those ball control kids that can help kind of keep everything going on the court. And one of the most important things to our staff as we're recruiting kids coming in is their personality and how they would fit into our team culture, because that's the most important thing that we feel like is going to help us win in the future, is creating that culture of family and creating that winning culture and really positive environment. And so we have to make sure that kids that we're recruiting fit into that and not just fit in volleyball-wise.
That's a really good point. So you talk about what they bring on the court and what they bring off the court. What have you seen so far? What have you seen? What kind of personalities do you have? What kind of energy has this team brought as a unit?
They've brought great energy. We have a big mix of personalities on our team. We have some kids that have a ton of energy and big, huge personalities, and then we have those quiet leaders that sit back a little bit more. So I think you need a good mix of everyone to make a team go, and I think we have that great mix so far.
So your schedule is released. You're going to get a good test early on with Penn State and a very talented program there.
Yeah.
I imagine you had a role in setting up this schedule.
Mm-hmm.
What when you work through, just to give a little bit of an in-depth perspective here, when you work through setting up a schedule like this, how do you balance the conference matchups and the, I guess you could call them, I don't want to call them the reach games, but the challenges against a team like Penn State?
So I think that you have to have a pretty good mix of matches that you feel like I don't want to say are for sure win, but you have a good chance of winning. You have to have some matches that challenge your team, which obviously is a situation like Penn State, and West Virginia is going to have a good squad back. They were really young last year, but they're expected to finish sixth, I think, this year in the Big 12, which is a big jump for them. And we have a good mix of matches that I feel like we can really win, and then matches that will be good challenges for our girls to see where they're at and to see where we need to go. And when we were looking at scheduling Penn State, at first I didn't want to do it because I didn't want to put our girls in a situation where they didn't feel like they could be successful. I think when you're building a program, one of the most important things is to win early, and that helps the team buy into what you're doing. And so being our second match, you know, wasn't really ideal to have us play Penn State. And so I talked to the girls about it and said, hey, look, we have this opportunity. What do you guys think? And they were like, yeah, let's do it. So as soon as I knew they were on board and they didn't feel like we were throwing them under the bus with it, I said, let's do it. You never know what can happen. Anyone can beat anyone on any given day. So,
well, this is a team that had a spectacular run towards the end of last season and ended up going all the way to the championship. You lose some seniors, so there has to be some adjustments there and some things to fix. But based on what we've seen with the program last year and what they are able to do, it's a team that's competitive in conference. So when you see that, do you consider in your mind, you know, maybe we can branch off and add these other games because we take care of business in our conference? Is that the kind of mindset, especially when you know you get more conference games down the road into, you know, September, October, November?
Right. And I think there's different ways to look at scheduling, and we have a conference tournament and some conferences don't. So when you don't have a conference tournament, you have to look at some other variables like what your record is going to be based on wins and losses of teams, and you have to look a little bit more at RPI and some of those things. But with us having a conference tournament, right now the only team that has gone traditionally to the NCAA tournament is the one that's won conference. And so for us, that's the end-all, be-all at the end of the day. Our pre-conference schedule isn't as important. It helps with RPI for our entire conference, but at the end of the day, you got to win the conference championship at the end.
What's kind of like a message for the fans? What's something the fans can kind of expect moving forward? Because I think some of us are guilty here. We don't watch as much volleyball as we'd like to, but just something for the fans and the students moving forward.
I think that we would love your support, and if you came to a match, you would be really excited about the girls and their passion and energy and love for the game and their love for UD Athletics, and it would be a really fun environment where you would want to come back.
There you go. This is Sarah Matthews, Delaware volleyball coach. We'll give you, we'll keep you for a couple more minutes, coach. I know you got to get running, but you talk about, I think one of the first things you said was this hidden gem of Delaware in which you saw the potential. And a lot of times people talk about, you know, what's your 5-year plan? What's your 10-year plan? What do you expect from this team 3 years down the road? Where do you see this team fitting into both your conference and on a national stage?
Well, our goal, when I talked to administration, when I first got hired, was obviously to win conference championships, and it might take us a year to get there. It might happen this year. It might take us 2 years. You never know. You have to see how adding kids influences that, but we definitely want to be at a point where we're winning conference, and obviously that takes us to the NCAA tournament, and then you got to go from there where, okay, now you make it first round and you see how that goes, and then now you're pushing, okay, we've been there, now we know what that's like. Now we're moving on to get to the second round. So I think step one is getting to the point where we get back to challenging to win a conference championship.
So just speaking of the conference championship, in the conference, are there any teams that stand out right now that you're looking at and that may be, you know, top competitors? And JMU is historically a very good program in the conference. Any other teams that have grabbed your attention in your preliminary scouting, we'll call it that?
You know, honestly, we haven't done a whole lot of scouting of other teams yet, because obviously once we start playing, that gives us an opportunity to watch in-conference matches, but so many things change from year to year with, obviously, we lost 6 seniors, so Delaware's a totally different team, and JMU lost one of their best player and conference player of the year, so dynamics change on teams, and we'll get to that point once we start playing our first matches. We have 4 weekends of pre-conference tournaments that we play in, and so we'll have a really good idea going into conference once that happens. But before that, we haven't scouted a whole lot of our conference opponents yet.
You're one of just many new coaches coming into this department over the last year or so. What do you think about where the department's headed as a whole?
I think there's going to be really big things for Delaware Athletics in the future. I think that the people that we have on staff and the coaches that we have joining our program are all on the same page. Everyone wants to win. Everyone's team player. Everyone's really buying into everything that that Chrissy's brought forward. And we talked as a group about being one of those mid-major schools that people don't look at as a mid-major school, that you're competing on that national level with some of those Power 5 conferences. And so that's our goal.
And you've settled into Delaware, all right.
Yes, thank you.
All right, Coach. Well, I know you got to get running to a meeting, so we will let you be on your way. Really excited we could get you on the show and kind of give us an idea as, you know, what you are looking for in this team, and continuing to cover the team, and excited because you get started very soon. We only got a couple weeks to go.
A week.
So I'll leave you with this. Final message, not just to fans, to university community, to anybody who follows your program intensely, those Delaware volleyball supporters listening right now, you know, what would you tell them?
I would tell them that we're really excited to have you guys at some matches and see that the work that these girls have put in and see where they're gonna go this season, because I think it's gonna be pretty special.
Talk about Delaware football for a brief moment. Teddy Gellman along with Brandon Holweck in a mid-quadri. Brandon, top 25 FCS preseason poll released the other day. JMU defending national champion sitting at number one.
Can't say it's much of a surprise. Last year, the team had just one loss en route to the FCS national championship, losing to the North Carolina Tar Heels early in the season. The Blue Hens, if you remember, played the Wake Forest Demon Deacons from the ACC. The Dukes did lose to the Tar Heels from North Carolina, but through their stretch run in the playoffs, beat some of the top teams in the FCS, North Dakota State being one of them, the team that had been at the top of this level for quite some time. They knocked them off, and they have some of their most important players coming back. Brian Shore, the quarterback chief among them, who was the preseason top guy in the CAA. So they got a lot going for them going into this next season.
Yeah, they might lose that running back, Abdullah, but their quarterback is pretty good, and they have a lot of starters returning as well. So not much of a surprise there. Another CAA team in the top 10 here, Richmond head coach Danny Rocco leaves them and comes here to Delaware. And on the surface, you might look at that and say, well, Richmond, number 7, that's kind of high for to be losing such a nice head coach who's had success in his career. However, this is a Richmond team that returns a lot of starters, a very solid team from top to bottom.
Absolutely. And again, it starts with the quarterback position for them. Kyle Lauletta returns as a fifth-year senior. He led the CAA in passing yards and was close to the top in passing efficiency last year. It'll be interesting to see how they adjust to not having Danny Rocco there, but I don't think it was necessarily a surprise with the way things went towards the end of the season that he decided to leave. There were some signs and down the stretch that he was looking at other options. So they get in there with their new head coach, I believe from Chattanooga, and they got time to adjust as the Blue Hens do as well. So I think we all expect Richmond to be another tough team to beat in the CAA, and even on the national scale. For a while last year, they ranked above James Madison until I think they had maybe one or two losses at the FCS level. So that's a tough team to beat as well.
Villanova's at number 10, New Hampshire at number 13, so you have four CAA teams, in the top 20. Delaware received a couple votes at the top 25 and ranked around number 57 on the FCS overall list here. Thoughts on the idea that the Blue Hens received votes? I know a lot of those are from the sports writers who may be slightly biased towards the Blue Hens, but do you feel any question over where they should be, or you think they're in an appropriate place at this point in the season?
I think they're an appropriate place. 57, not the most generous, but I've said it before, you also have to kind of factor in ceiling and end result or where you plan on a team of really finishing. And I think that whether we like it or not, we're not expecting them to make a huge run. This is a team that I think all of us collectively have predicted 500 or just a little bit better. And when you factor all of that in, they may not have the highest of ceilings. So I think a 50, 57, you know, even if they made it to the 40s, I think that's a fair assessment.
Absolutely. I think as a Blue Hens fan and one who watches the team, you got to keep your eyes inside the CAA. I think the first thing is getting to the middle or the top of the CAA, and then you can start looking around the FCS and see the opponents across the nation. But ranked, I believe, 5th in the CAA. That's a good spot for them, just over the halfway mark of the 12 CAA teams. If they could achieve that, I think that this would be a successful season, and then they can start looking at the North Dakota States and the James Madisons of the world seasons down the road as those teams continue to lose players and the Blue Hens hopefully continue to build.
Three weeks from today, the Blue Hens host Delaware State in the first game of the season at home. And until we get to that point, there's a lot of shuffling going on between the rosters. Walk-ons, players coming onto the team, coming off the team. We have a couple we'd like to get to. And, Brandon, one that you're familiar with, Amid, you too, as being local from the area, a running back who went to Lackawanna College in Candy Cane, who is coming
back.
Can
you say that again?
Lackawanna College. Like that, I have never heard of Lackawanna College until I saw this, but a smaller school. But coming back to the area, and a guy who's going to bring more depth to the running back position.
Yeah, obviously, we talked about Wes Hills a couple weeks ago. He won't be on the team this year, and I think there's also been some question marks about an injury to Kareem Williams in preseason. He expects to be back and healthy at the start of the year, but he has missed time in practice, so it's good to get another depth option. They have Kane, the guy from Sussex Tech who People downstate will know racked up thousands of rushing yards down there in the Henlopen Conference. Plus, they also moved Riley Angeline from the wide receiver tight end position back into the backfield where he played in high school. So they added a few options as far as backs to give a boost in case something happens to Thomas Jefferson and Kareem Williams if, you know, injuries inevitably come up. And obviously, West Hill's the big loss in the backfield already. So some extra depth with it, which I think is going to be a good thing for the Blue Hens.
Yeah, and we'll find, going off of this theme of the transfers coming in, we're going to find soon enough who of the incoming players will be redshirted, because from what we're hearing, you know, there's a lot going on at the wide receiver position, and there's been some really good young receivers, and they're not all going to play this year.
Yeah, the two recruits that we definitely know of, Thyrick Pitts and Ty McElhenney, have been at practice, but again, we don't know if they'll play as freshmen. Last year, Chichi Amachi was the only true freshman wide receiver to get action for the Blue Hens. So these guys might redshirt, but it does seem to be kind of an open competition, especially at the wide receiver position, which has, you know, not been a strength of the Blue Hens, certainly. I wouldn't be surprised if a Joey Carter, who's a redshirt freshman, or a Thyrick Pitts does get playing time, but at the same time, I don't know exactly what the approach will be there yet. There's still a lot to iron out as far as that depth chart in the preseason goes.
So we'll see what happens soon enough, because they're going to be working on that depth chart, and we're seeing some depth offensively with this team. Defensively, even with the losses of Larry Spears and Jason Thompson, there's been some guys to step up. We're keeping an eye on Colby Reeder. I know last week when we had Hannah Trader on the show, she was talking about how she talked to Colby's brother Troy and what they're bringing defensively. So overall, they haven't been hitting a lot in practice. They've been working their way up, but we expect there to be some scrimmages soon enough so far. Has there been anything so far at this point in camp, anything you've seen, anything you've heard that's impressed you, or anything on the other end of it that you are still looking to learn more about, or something you're questioning?
I still want to learn more about how the quarterbacks are doing. Joe Walker, J.P. Caruso, the top two that are battling for that starting spot. And then I also want to see the wide receiver position, like I just mentioned. I think that there's an opportunity to see a lot of new names there that we didn't see in the years prior, but not exactly sure who those will be, because there's a lot of guys in that conversation and in that mix at the wide receiver group.
I like how it goes from that song to a little bit of 50 Snoop right there, but you're listening to the Blue Hen Sports Cage, and it's time for our coveted segment, Cage Rage. I'll go first here, and yes, I've talked about him before. No, I'm not talking about LaVar Ball. I'm talking about Mayweather and Conor McGregor. Just getting a little ready for this fight here. A little bit of sparring going on. Hopefully you guys are keeping up with it. McGregor knocked out one of his sparring guys. There's a little bit of controversy there. McGregor getting ready, looking good. Mayweather, I don't know what kind of approach he's taking to this fight. A little bit of a different approach. I like how both of these guys are handling it, but he just came out the other day, Mayweather I'm talking about, and he said, on paper, I quote, on paper, McGregor has me beat. Now, look, I understand where he's going with this. They're already kind of, and maybe I'm speculating, but some of these guys are already looking for a possible rematch to the super fight here, this $100 plus million fight. This could even go into the close to the range of $500 million, half a billion dollars. A little bit of a reach there, but both of these sides really doing their best to promote it, and I get that, but to say, you know, that he's going to beat you to kind of generate this interest, there's already enough interest generated here. I like both of these guys, but they really need to stick to fighting and not stick to promoting or being marketers. I don't get it. Mayweather can just ride off into the sunset and go 50-0 here. I think these guys are already looking into the future too much. Stick to boxing or MMA or whatever it is. Fight this guy here. And if you're Mayweather, you know, get your money and run and pay your taxes. Don't worry about that next fight to the next fight. I'm looking forward to this fight. Please don't ruin it for everyone.
This past week, former Crimson Tide quarterbacks Blake Barnett and Cooper Bateman offered some criticism for head coach or former head coach Nick Saban. Both quarterbacks were assured that they'd have playing time at the beginning of last season. Blake Barnett, who was the number one quarterback in the class of 2015 of all players across the nation, as according to ESPN.com, thought he would be the starter. And it turned out that Jalen Hurts ended up playing in that game, the season opener, and played the entire rest of the season. And these quarterbacks now, who have both transferred, Barnett to Arizona State and Bateman to Utah, are both coming out. And they're saying how frustrated they were that, oh, coach told me I had a spot, and he ended up playing somebody else, and I never got my chance. Barnett quit the team. He left after week four, so he'd be eligible to play elsewhere. And Saban's main criticism was, these guys gave up on our team. They gave up on this. Sure, maybe Saban shouldn't make guarantees that he can't keep, but these players, just because they weren't starting, immediately transfer, especially Blake Barnett in week four of the season transferred, so he'd be eligible to play this year. I understand looking out for yourself in the year after, saying, you know what, I didn't get playing time. Jalen Hurts had an excellent season. I'm not going to get playing time here. I need to go somewhere else. But you had a chance at a national championship. That's something you stick around for, and you be part of the team. You committed to that team when you signed your national letter of intent back in 2015 as the number one quarterback in the class. If you were really the best quarterback of that class, you would have had that job. They would have played you over Jalen Hurts. I understand transferring, but mid-season, that's quitting on your team. And again, if you were the best quarterback for the Crimson Tide, you would have played. Jalen Hurts last year was the best quarterback for the Alabama Crimson Tide. And as we'll talk about later, he's a Heisman candidate this year because of what he did both through the air and on the ground.
All those mentions of Barnett makes me miss that big man Barnett Harris of the Blue Hens basketball team. But Brandon, a very valid cage rage there, and I'll wrap it up with this. Adrian Beltre, he got tossed from a game a couple weeks ago, and then he got into this scuffle with umpire Joe West, a very veteran umpire. And then West comes out and says some things about Beltre, saying that Beltre is the biggest complainer he knows. And he says, you know what, he's a great ball player, and he's probably going to go into the Hall of Fame. Just got his 3,000th hit. But Adrian Beltre is a bad complainer. Joe West got suspended 3 games. You know what, Joe West, come on now. You need to stop this complaining. There's a lot of baseball players that complain. But Adrian Beltre also got tossed for a game for a reason that made absolutely no sense. So please give the guy a little bit of respect here. Don't tell him that he's the worst complainer you know, but he's a great ball player. He is one of the finest ball players left. Show him some respect, and maybe you'll get back on the field soon enough. 3 games for an umpire, we don't hear about that too often. But Joe West, suspended 3 games. Come on, man. Let's move over to some MLB right now. First, we want to get to the trade that happened yesterday. Jay Bruce from the New York Mets, formerly of the Cincinnati Reds, has been traded from New York to Cleveland to be a part of the Cleveland Indians' run towards what they hope will be a second straight appearance in the World Series. The outfielder has had a nice career. He's made the All-Star team a couple times on first impression. First look, Brandon, how much better does this make the Indians?
Well, it fills a need for sure. They just put Michael Brantley, their starting left fielder, on the disabled list. So Jay Bruce figures in right away, and then he'll continue playing as a everyday corner outfielder through the rest of the season. The batting average isn't where you'd love it to be, .256 this season, a career .249 hitter. But I was surprised to see that Bruce has 29 home runs this year. Not a guy that you hear a lot about.
Quiet. He's
as
really
a big
quiet
power hitter in this league. Exactly. His career high is 34, so he's on pace to go well over that, and the Indians are hoping to capitalize on that, and they could use some bats for sure. Francisco Lindor, their shortstop, has had a good year, not a great year. Kipnis, their second baseman, has dealt with injury. The strength of this team is the pitching staff for sure, but I think Jay Bruce gives them a boost. I think he makes them a little bit better than they were yesterday.
Are the Mets I wish we could have Jake here for a second, but at the same time, it wasn't worth it to get Jake on the phone just to talk about the Mets for a minute. But and that's
for Jake it is.
And that's not meant to be an insult in any capacity here.
No, you're not going to get him on for one question.
I'm not asking him that, but are the Mets, what are they doing here? Are they
rebuilding?
Are they kind of stuck in the middle? What's happening?
I'd say
they still got a lot of good pitchers.
Yeah, I don't think you get rid of
injured pitchers that are good.
Right. But yeah, I don't think you get rid of Jacob DeGrom or Harvey or Syndergaard because they're all relatively inexpensive and controllable. But it's a rebuild of sorts. They traded Addison Reed at the deadline. Now you get rid of Bruce. I think it's the start of a rebuild. I think if they don't get better next year, if their pitchers aren't healthy next year, then you might see even more pieces go from this team.
So you think the Indians This does not make them above the rest favorites in the AL. It's not that much. Not the magnitude of that.
That's accurate.
That is accurate.
No, yeah, what you said. It's not a magnitude of a deal that's going to make them significantly better than the Red Sox or the Yankees or the Mariners, the Rangers, the teams that are fighting for division titles and those two wild card spots, but I think it makes them a little bit better.
Well, there's quite a race going on in the AL right now, wild card. Just a brief mention here. Some of the teams have picked it up. The Mariners are now currently in the second wild card spot. That's a team, 59 and 56. Royals, one game back. Tampa Bay Rays, one game back. Twins, 1.5 back. Angels, 2 back. And the Orioles, 2.5 back. So quite a race in the AL. Yankees have the first spot and a lead of 2.5 games. And the division leaders in the AL, the Red Sox, the Indians, and the Astros. And a quick recap in the NL. Nationals leading the NL East. Cubs, 1.5 games. Very quickly, though, the St. Louis Cardinals are climbing up in the Central. They're only a game and a half out. They've won 5 in a row. And in the West, the Dodgers picked up their 80th win yet last night. Cody Bellinger, another home run. And the Dodgers have the best record in baseball, 80-33. We'll be keeping you updated on the standings as we continue to move through August now into September. But we would like to get into a discussion today involving some big names, Bryce Harper, Mike Trout, and Barry Bonds. How do they all connect? Well, here's why. Bryce Harper and Mike Trout both hit their 150th home runs at the exact same age, 24 years and 95 days. Now, Trout just turned, correct me if I'm wrong, 27.
26.
Oh, Amit, you were wrong earlier.
I was off by a
year. I don't mean to throw you under the bus, but okay.
But then again, what do I know about baseball?
I trusted you here. You know the Yankees are good. They've been good.
Yeah.
Okay, so
Aaron Judge is 25. That's all I care about.
Aaron Judge has struggled, too, recently since the All-Star break. He's really struggled.
On pace for like 211 strikeouts or something this year?
He struck out in, we just had it up, it's like 20-something consecutive games.
Yeah.
Curse of the home run derby, maybe? Who knows? But anyways,
yeah, I think pitchers are catching up.
So Harper and Trout. Harper, just the other day, I think it was on Monday, he hit his 150th home run on the day of his 24th year and 95th day. And Trout did that just a few years ago. Also on Monday was the 10-year anniversary of Barry Bonds' 756th home run, which, as you would know, leads baseball in terms of career home run lists. Now, let's take it another step, and let's look at the list of current players and home runs. Albert Pujols, 608, Miguel Cabrera, 459, Beltre, 456, Carlos Beltran, 434, and Ryan Howard at number 5, 382. We don't want to get ahead of ourselves in this conversation, understanding the implications of what we are about to say. However, Harper and Trout are very young, and they've now got 150-plus, and Trout, correct me if I'm wrong here, too, but I think he's up near 200 now.
In home runs?
A home run.
191.
191. Okay, so he'll be there, I assume, before the season is over. He'll get to 200. Giancarlo Stanton is a young guy, too, and he's moving up. He's at 246. So, in an overall sense right now, is there anybody in one of the current players on this list, somebody down the way, anybody have a chance at catching Barry Bonds just after the 10th year that he set the record?
I got one for you.
Yeah.
This might surprise you. I'm going to say Mike Trout.
Why would that surprise?
Because he's not a home run hitter the same way Barry Bonds is. Like, he's not going to hit 73 home runs in a season. But at this pace, he is ahead of where Barry Bonds was when Barry Bonds was in his age 25 season. Trout has 191 career home runs to this point, as we mentioned, and Barry Bonds, at that point in his career, had 142 home runs. Then he went on steroids, so we can put that into the discussion
allegedly,
as well. But he did, but but I don't think it's I think it would be hard like I said, Mike Trout's not going to hit 73 home runs in a year. He's not going to have a five-year stretch where he hits over 40 home runs in every season. But he could be close. I'm not going to write off 500 or 600 home runs in his career, provided health doesn't become an issue for him.
If I had to pick one, it's either Bryce Harper or Mike Trout. I'll probably have to lean a little bit towards Bryce Harper for the sole reason that you said Mike Trout's not really a home run hitter. And I think that's enough really to kind of choose Bryce Harper. I think Bryce Harper, although being younger, I think he's just a overall better home run hitter. That's really all I can say. I just don't see Mike Trout sustaining 30, 40 home runs a season
for the next, you know, 10, 11 years. I just don't see that happening. If anyone, I could see, you know, Bryce Harper maybe squeezing out a couple 50-plus home run seasons. I could see that happening. I just don't see Mike Trout doing even another 40 home run season.
You know, Jay Bruce is number 15 on this list with 270. This is a guy who just goes, you mentioned it a few minutes ago, a guy just goes about his business and keeps it to himself, kind of like Joey Votto did. It was the theme of the Reds, the middle of that lineup for a while. I think that an interesting name here is Giancarlo Stanton. He turned 27, he's on his way to becoming 28 soon, and Trout turned 26, so this is less than 2 years that Stanton is ahead of Trout, and Stanton is at 246. However, he was injured for a good portion of the early part of his career, back when he was known as Mike Stanton and he was injured. I think if Giancarlo Stanton stays healthy, he could, I don't want to say get it, but he could challenge. Giancarlo Stanton could be up there near the Cabreras and the Pujols and in the 400 to 600 range. To me, I just don't see anybody getting up there in 700 right now.
Like, I don't think anybody's going to take steroids because they're going to get caught and thrown out of the game. And I do think that's a big reason why Barry Bonds has 762 or 63, whatever it is. I think health is going to be the thing with Stanton. If looking at his numbers right now, he averages 43 home runs across the 162-game season, but his career high is this year with 38 home runs. He just hasn't had a full season where he's been able to put up those high home run numbers. We know he can do it. His home run numbers are impressive, 246, as you said, in his career, and he still is very young, but I would be concerned health going forward because that is a huge mountain to climb to get another 500 home runs in his career.
So if you think right now, maybe 10 years down the road when Trout is 36, and who knows, he probably, based on who he is, will still be playing at that point, and he'll have a couple more years in him. Do you think, I'm trying to elaborate and articulate on the legacies here, and I want to be careful how I approach Barry Bonds, because he still is the leader. You can't deny that, statistically speaking, he's the leader, but there is the whole conversation, the controversy over the steroids and what went on there. How do you feel like some of these younger guys, most notably Trout and Harper, where will they fit in your minds, 10, 12, 13 years down the road, when they're wrapping up their careers? Where will they fit, historically speaking? Are we talking about a Carlos Beltran, Adrian Beltre? Is this a guy, these guys that are going to be up there in Bonds minus the steroids? Or are we somewhere in the middle, or are we less than all of that? Where would you put them if you had to make a prediction now?
Maybe this won't surprise you, and I'll say this knowing that with all of these players, we can't predict what will happen with injuries. You could say Ken Griffey Jr. was maybe on track to be better than Barry Bonds, greatest player of all time, but injuries hampered his career. I'm going to say Mike Trout right now. He is sixth, if you just take players age 20 to 26 seasons, he's sixth all-time in wins above replacement with 52.9. Barry Bonds, at that same point in his career, was 26th. So he's above that pace of Barry Bonds in terms of wins above replacement. He has two MVPs to his name at this point in his career. Barry Bonds had just one, and Trout has also been voted second in the MVP race three times. He's a six-time All-Star. All of those counting awards are going to continue for Mike Trout, and I think I think there's no reason to think that the performance is going to diminish anytime soon. This is a guy who's just now hitting his stride. He is just entering the prime of his career, and he's already had arguably five MVP quality seasons. He's a five-tool player. I think he could add another MVP or maybe a second place this season. That's a discussion we'll continue down the stretch. With all of that combined, I think Mike Trout is the guy of this era who has the best chance to put himself in the category of the best players of all time. And I also say that knowing that he's facing some of the best pitching of all time that we've seen. We haven't seen, up until this year, the type of dominant pitching that we've seen of the past 5 years with Clayton Kershaw, Madison Bumgarner, Max Scherzer, you name it. There are guys that are dominating right now. It wasn't until this year that home runs and runs were up across the board in Major League Baseball. Mike Trout.
There's a lot of discussion on if or where Bryce Harper might go following the 2018 season when he's eligible for free agency. Is Mike Trout hurting himself or helping himself, or is this a moot point and this doesn't matter if he stays in L.A. with the Angels the whole time, or Do you think that if Trout ended up going to a team that gets more competitive, or if the Angels get more competitive, could that help it? Is there more runs to drive in? Are there things like that? Or are you not considering anything like that?
I think in modern-day baseball, like, you can isolate what he does and take that and compare it against Bryce Harper or Mookie Betts, somebody who's on a team that's going to have more wins. I think 20 years ago you would have said, look at this guy. He's got two seasons in his career above 100 RBIs. Like, why are we so excited about him? He's only gone over 30 home runs three times in his career. He's a solid middle-of-the-lineup guy. But we can see the contributions. We can see how efficient he is at the plate, how he's gotten on base at a .410 clip in his career. There are things that can be measured that we didn't necessarily measure with Barry Bonds. The defensive impact, for instance, where I think that you can isolate enough of what Mike Trout does to still value him, even though he may or may not win a World Series in his career.
Well, I got called out on Twitter the other day for saying that Joe Flacco and Matt Ryan are equivalent because they're on the same level because they both have, or excuse me, I got called out on Twitter for saying that they are not equivalent for Joe Flacco having the ring and Matt Ryan not, and I kind of jumping to the conclusion in the NFL saying that how significant a ring is. That's the difference here in baseball. I don't know how significant a World Series ring is in terms of a player's individual legacy. In the NBA and in the NFL, that's all you hear about. But in baseball, you know, if Mike Trout continues this pace and he plays on an average Angels team, I don't see as much of an asterisk by his spot. This is not a Dan Marino, like, oh, you know, look what he did regular season,
but he never got it done.
And I'm trying to understand why, but you just don't hear about that as much. And I don't know if that's because there are more players on the field at the same time in baseball when you got 9 players in the field and not just 5 on the basketball court. And if you're a quarterback in the NFL and you're calling the shots and doing everything, there's more pressure on you. I'm not sure, but I can see where you're going with that, in that maybe that success, team success, doesn't mean as much.
Yeah. And again, it's not as simple as just saying, well, look, he walks a lot. He's a really efficient player. It's tough, but you can try to separate, okay, what is the pitcher contributing to this? What is the fielder contributing to him getting hit? You know, is this a hit against an average fielder? Is this a hit against a below-average fielder? And so on. You can kind of get into the metrics more in baseball with weighted runs created, wins above replacement, these things that are becoming more and more prevalent as people like us talk about the sport. Whereas in football especially, it is extremely difficult to isolate each individual player and what they're doing on each play without watching the play 24 times and watching each individual player on that play. And most of us don't have the time or the desire to do that. In basketball, 5 players on the court. So LeBron James is definitely going to get a lot more flack if he doesn't win a game, because in a lot of cases you can say, well, we need a basket right now. Let's give it to LeBron, and it's up to him to actually get it done. Whereas in baseball, we need a run right now. Well, Mike Trout might not be up. So he can't do it if he's not at the plate. There are definitely some differences that would contribute to that.
And I feel like we've talked about that over the last couple of weeks when we refer to lineups in baseball, and we talk about Clayton Kershaw being injured, and if this is LeBron being injured here, what that does for the Cavaliers. But if you punch Mike Trout out of the lineup for an injured back or something, and Bryce Harper's out of the lineup, but you still got really good hitters in Washington, is the team suddenly going to be so far worse? And the answer is no.
And in one game, too.
In one game.
Mike Trout might have been 0 for 4 anyway, and he's still the best player on the field, but he was 0 for 4 that night. Another guy you might not have heard of could go 3 for 4, but, you know, you average it out over 162 games, and you kind of get these results and these larger scale numbers that we're talking about.